At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
All right, welcome back. We're doing another week of the Absite Review. The Absite is rapidly approaching, so we're going to continue. This is a much-requested topic on Twitter. Everybody's requested that we cover stomach, so we're going to cover stomach today. And I'm here with John McClellan, who everybody knows, and Rowan Sheldon, who's one of the up-and-coming R2s.
I'm currently an R2.
Currently R2.
I'm actually on your team right now. You should probably know that.
Oh, yeah. I probably should know that.
Yeah.
You know, you just seem like so much of an intern most of the time that it's hard to believe that you're actually an R2. But Rowan's one of our smarter residents, so he's going to take us through and answer a lot of these questions correctly. So jumping right into it, stomach absite review. So John, let's start at the basics. Let's start with anatomy, blood supply. Blood supply to the stomach. Go.
So the best way to break this down is if you think about the branches that come off, you know, first off the celiac trunk, which gives life to the left gastric, the common hepatic and splenic, but then you think of the left gastric as supplying a portion of the lesser curvature. And also you have the greater curvature, which is supplied by the left and right gastropleuric, as well as the short gastrics. And then just remember, for your anatomy, sometimes this comes up on the absite, is that the right gastropleuric is a branch of the GDA. And then you have your lesser curve, which I already mentioned with the left gastric, but also supplied by the right gastric. And the right gastric comes off of the proper hepatic artery, which comes after the GDA is branched off.
So definitely seen that asked a few times, specifically the branches of the branches of the celiac, and the one they seem to like is the where the right gastric comes off. So the right gastric, it will typically come off your proper hepatic, and then your common hepatic is going to branch into your proper hepatic and your gastroduodenal artery. And John, the main cellular, what's the main cell that's makes up the stomach mucosa? What kind of cell is that?
It's simple columnar cells throughout the stomach. And as also you have some mucus secreting cells in there as well, but that's mainly in the cardiac gland itself.
Okay. So, Rowan, favorite abside topic is the different types of cells in the stomach, where they're located, what they secrete. So when you think about the fundus and body of the stomach, what cells are you thinking about there? What cells live in the fundus and body of the stomach?
Sure. So you have two different types of cells there. You have the chief cells, which mainly secrete your pepsinogen. And it's kind of what I think of as like that's the actual purpose of the stomach, is to break down proteins. It's the chief role, so it's the chief cell. And then you have the parietal cell, which releases your acid, and it releases intrinsic factor. And so the parietal being kind of what creates the environment of the stomach itself.
And what's that stimulated by?
This is where they get you. It's the three separate stimuli. You have the vagus, which has acetylcholine, and then you have gastrin coming from the G cells, and then histamine being the third.
Okay, so moving down, so anatomically, the stomach antrum, what's secreted from the stomach antrum?
This is the important part when you're talking about your surgeries for ulcers and specifically getting rid of all the gastrin, because you can have retained antral syndrome where you end up with the hyperstimulation of the gastrin due to the lack of acid hitting these G cells and downregulating them. And so that's the big thing that's down in the antrum of the stomach. But you also have some of your D cells in that antral area, which secretes your somatostatin and basically downregulates everything.
Yep. So G cells, gastrin, that's easy to remember. G, gastrin starts with G. D cells, somatostatin. Actually, I just got a practice question about this. So for bonus points, what do you think if you had a retained antrum syndrome, what do you think your basal stomach acid would be? What would the gastrin level be? Just high or low? So basal acid, what do you think it would be?
Basal acid would be low, then your gastrin would actually be high.
No, your basal acid would be high. So you have your antrum that continues to make gastrin and it drives your basal acid output of your stomach high. How would your gastrin respond to a secretin stimulation test?
It would drop in comparison to a gastrinoma.
Correct. So if you had a gastrinoma, so the normal response from secretin is a decrease in gastrin. An abnormal response if you have a gastrinoma is that it will rise. So if you have retained antrum, your basal output is going to be high, your gastrin is going to be high, and your gastrin is going to decrease with secretin.
Yeah, so you're functionally decoupling your acid cells from your G cells, and you take away the negative feedback loop.
Right, exactly. So I got a practice question, that exact practice question recently. Okay, so... let's move on to some different problems you can have with your stomach. So what are the different types of gastric volvulus, John?
Well, I think the one everybody thinks about is the organoaxial volvulus, and that's most likely going to be the answer if they ask what type of volvulus is a gastric volvulus. Mm-hmm. And that's usually treated by, just reducing the volvulus itself and then an isofund application to help repair the problem.
So what are your lead points for your organoaxial, if you were to draw an axis for your volvulus? Because they will ask this. They'll ask, how does the stomach volvulize?
So we think of it would be the GE junction right by your intrastura to the pylorus.
Yep. So if you draw your axis, from your GE junction down to your pylorus, and then the stomach volvulizes around that axis, that's organoaxial, and that's the most common. How do you treat that?
So you would treat that with a reducing the volvulus itself and then a nisofundification, and then you make sure you close your cura up as, typical procedure.
Okay. Something that's frequently tested is you have, somebody who's maybe an alcoholic, maybe drinking, they have some forceful vomiting, and then they have some hematemesis after that. What is that?
Yeah, so the most common thing here would be a Mallory Weiss tear, and that's just a mucosal tear. So this is typically just EGD and clip it functionally. And it's typically along the lesser curve. I think you get kind of at your tether point near the GE junction.
Right, exactly. So they will ask that sometimes, where the actual tears occur, and it's on the lesser curvature of the stomach. I think some people often think that it's always in the esophagus, but the most common place for those tears is the lesser curvature of the stomach. Okay, moving on. So we've talked about, high acid output conditions a little bit. And so let's talk about, we talked about how the vagus contributes to acid production by stimulating those parietal cells to produce acid. So let's talk about the different types of vagotomies. So in general terms, what are we thinking about when we think about the two main types of vagotomies that are used today?
You can either go with a truncal vagotomy or you go with a more selective vagotomy, either being a selective or a highly selective vagotomy.
Okay. And just explain this to me. What's a truncal vagotomy? What's a highly selective vagotomy?
With a truncal vagotomy, you go well up on the esophagus, and I think it's 5 centimeters up on the esophagus, and you make sure that you get the left and the right being the anterior and the posterior. And the key there with going up on the esophagus is really to make sure that you get above the criminal nerve of Grassi, because mm-hmm. That's the typical one that will still kind of hose you if you don't get up high enough. If you go to the selective vagotomies, you're trying to maintain your vagus innervation to the liver. And so you come down below the hepatic branches and attempt to get just your stomach fibers.
Which one does that those branches to the liver, the hepatic branches of the vagus come off of? Your left, right, anterior, posterior?
So I always remembered this with LARP, mm-hmm. The left becoming anterior and the right becoming posterior, going along with the twisting of the foregut. And so the left one being your anterior is going to go and continue over to the liver, whereas your posterior coming from your right is going to become your celiac axis.
Yeah, I think that would be easy for you to remember. You kind of seem like a LARPer to me. I always kind of thought of you as a LARPer.
And Jason, remind me the differences, similarities and differences of the how the emptying the stomach goes for each of the vagotomies.
Sure. So both in a truncal vagotomy and a highly selective vagotomy, you got to think about your stomach's relaxation. So you lose that receptive relaxation, that reflex. So when you think about that, that's going to increase your emptying of liquids from your stomach. So both will increase the emptying of liquids. Right. The difference comes when it's solids, and that has to do with your pylorus. So if you have a truncal vagotomy, you lose the innervation of your pylorus, so you're going to have decreased solid emptying. Unless you perform a pyloroplasty, and that negates that. So then you're going to have, I guess, increased emptying of your solids with that pyloroplasty. With your highly selective, you still have the innervation to your pylorus, so you should have normal solid emptying.
And you may see that show up as in you have normal innervation because you still preserve the crow's foot that goes down into the pylorus. And then, you know, the results of a truncal vagotomy. So if this does come up, you decrease your acid output by 90%. There's increased gastrin overall from gastrin cell hyperplasia, but just due to less exposure to acid. And other things you may get from a truncal vagotomy, you have decreased exocrine pancreatic function, decreased bile flow, increased gallbladder volume, think it's not contracting as much, and then decreased vagally mediated hormones.
And Rowan, the most common complication that you're going to have after a vagotomy, the thing that the patient is going to complain about.
So chances are they're going to complain of diarrhea.
Exactly. So these patients will, after any type of vagotomy, the most common complaint afterwards is diarrhea. And that has to do with the bile acids and your sustained MMCs. Treatment for that?
Because it's due to bile acids, you're going to give them cholestyramine.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Moving on, let's talk about another favorite topic, which is bleeding. Upper GI bleed. First off, what defines an upper GI bleed?
Anything above the ligament attrites is going to be an upper GI bleed.
Right. And what's the first line treatment for any upper GI bleed?
As with anything that comes in acutely, it's going to be your ABCs, two large bore IVs, adequate resuscitation, and then specifically for the upper GI bleed, it's going to be early endoscopy.
Right. Localize, you know, resuscitate and find the source of your bleeding. So endoscopy, endoscopy, endoscopy. So let's say you do an upper endoscopy. What are some different possibilities that you can see as far as how do you characterize the ulcer if you have a bleeding ulcer?
Yeah, and they do usually ask this question on the website in regards to what are the chances of rebleeding. So if you look inside with endoscopy and you see an actively bleeding vessel, then you typically have a 60% chance of that area rebleeding. If you see a visible blood vessel, maybe the base of the ulcer, you have a 40% chance. And then if you have diffuse, you know, stomach oozing and maybe not able to isolate a specific bleeder, you have a 30% chance of rebleeding.
Right. So I've seen that, you know, this comes up in real life. This comes up on board scenarios. It comes up on tests, comes up on rounds. So upper endoscopy, you can't control the bleeding. The patient's unstable. What do you do?
OR. I mean, that's the answer for most patients who are unstable. And especially on the app site. So, and then also you want to perform or also treat them for empirically for H. pylori.
What if they're bleeding and they've already been treated? You have documented evidence that they've already been treated for H. pylori. What do you have to do at the time of operation?
We also want to go back to your vagotomies as well at that point.
So. Right. So you want to at least think about doing an acid-reducing operation. Okay. So moving a little bit further down, we talked about some, you know, gastric ulcers. So duodenal ulcers. So where do we typically find duodenal ulcers?
This would be in the first portion of the duodenum, in the duodenal bulb.
Yeah, the duodenal bulb in the first portion of the duodenum. And they can present in a couple different ways. What are the two main ways that they can present?
Well, you have, based on the anatomy, the anterior and the posterior perforations. So if you have an anterior, that's when you're more likely going to have a free perforation into the peritoneum, so you'll end up with pneumoperitoneum. And if you have a posterior, this is where the GDA is running behind, so you can have an ulcer kind of necrosing into the GDA itself.
Right. So anteriors perforate, posteriors bleed. You know, the most devastating bleed is when the ulcer or when you ulcerate right into that that big gastroduodenal artery, and that can be quite devastating. What's more common, a perforation or a bleed?
Bleed would be more
Bleeding's
common.
Bleeding's more common. Bleeding's definitely more common. So let's go back to it. So you have, again, upper GI bleed. What's your first step?
So that's where we go back to our ABCs, two large bore IVs, resuscitation, endoscopy.
Resuscitation, endoscopy. So you try to treat these endoscopically with clips, with epinephrine injection, with cautery. Let's say they give you the situation where, you know, your endoscopist can't stop the bleeding, the patient's unstable. What do you do then?
And we're assuming we have a duodenal ulcer?
Yep. You do your endoscopy. You see a posterior duodenal ulcer with it's just welling up blood. And they can't control it.
So we take the patient to the operating room. We're going to do a duodenotomy. And then this is where we're going to do our GDA ligation.
Okay.
And the important thing to remember here is that this is the three-suture ligation. So not only do you have to get the proximal and the distal, but you also have to get the transverse pancreatic branch that's going to be going medial at this point.
Yep. So what do you mean by proximal and distal? What do you mean by that? Where are you going to throw your sutures?
So if you have a kind of the pinpoint crater that's bleeding out at you, you'll get one superior, one inferior, and then one basically to the right side as you're looking at it, which would be medial.
Right. That is in fact the textbook answer. And bonus points. What needle are you going to ask for? What suture? What needle?
I'd probably ask for a 2-0 vicryl on, or an ovicryl on a UR6.
Ovicryl UR6. Right. So you want that sharp curve of the needle so that you can get down there and get that. What do you have to be careful that you don't hit? You don't ligate. What runs in that area that if you ligate with the artery, you could have trouble.
Well, you definitely don't want to ligate the common bile duct.
Correct.
You'd be very careful, especially when you're throwing that medial stitch.
Okay, so let's move. So that's your posterior bleeding. That's a surgical treatment of a posterior bleeding duodenal ulcer. How about an anterior perforation? What operation are you going to do in that situation?
So your go-to operation here is a Gram patch using a Mentum as well as an acid-reducing procedure, only if the patient has been on a PPI prior to surgery.
So let's flesh that out a little bit. What do you mean by a Gram patch? What is that?
So you would throw two sutures into the anterior portion of the duodenum and then bring up a piece of omentum. And in using those sutures, you would tie the omentum to the anterior portion of the duodenum, cinching it down, not extremely tight, but enough to cover the hole.
Yeah, so classically, you know, the Gram patch, you don't primarily close the hole itself. You'll put, you know, I don't think there's a number on the sutures, two or three sutures, full thickness, you know, silk sutures. You'll create a tongue of omentum, flop it up to cover the hole, and patch the hole with the omentum. You know, nowadays, a lot of people, depending on the size of the ulcer and depending on how healthy the tissue, you know, looks around the ulcer, they will do a primary closure and then patch over the top with the tongue of omentum. But I think for the abscite, yeah, a Gram patch using omentum. And then you of course, have to think about their H. pylori status, if they've been treated for that. If they haven't been treated for that, you don't need to do an acid-reducing procedure. But if you know they've been on PPI and they've been treated for H. pylori, you at least have to think about that. And along those lines, Rowan, so what is the treatment for H. pylori?
So there's a couple different ways that this can present on these test questions. I know that there's both triple and quadruple therapy. And so the standard is that you do amoxicillin, clarithromycin, and a PPI. For your quad therapy, you can add bismuth to that. But I've definitely seen, I think, amoxicillin, flagyl, and bismuth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it'll show up in a whole bunch of different ways.
Yeah, I think, amoxicillin, clarithromycin, and a PPI. And then you can, there are some places that do substitute out metronidazole. What's the best test to test for H. pylori?
Gold standard would be an EGD with biopsies.
EGD with biopsy and histology. What's the most sensitive?
I believe that's the antibody test.
The antibody, yep. So the serum antibody test. What is the best test for documenting resolution of an H. pylori infection?
That's where you do your urease breath test.
Right, urease breath test.
Because the other ones aren't useful anymore.
Yeah, yep. So let's say you have a young patient who presents with no real risk factors. They have multiple duodenal ulcers. They have ulcers that are not in the first portion, that are a little more distal. What do you have to think of and rule out?
So you must be thinking this patient in gastrinoma or Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. Yeah. It's certainly something you want to put in your differential.
And how do you diagnose gastrinoma?
A couple of different tests you can perform. The first thing is just growing a gastrin level. And usually,
what would be a diagnostic number?
A diagnostic number is usually greater than a 200, but you also, it would be significantly diagnostic if it's in the thousands.
So yeah, over 1,000 is kind of the, this is a gastrinoma.
I have definitely seen it where they've given a gastrinoma presentation and they only have a gastrin number of like 300 though. So
what would you do then?
You would also do your secretin stimulation test.
Correct. Okay, so again, still on the subject of ulcers, still on the subject of even H. pylori, but let's just talk about a little bit about gastric ulcers. There's several different types of gastric ulcers, and sometimes I'll describe an ulcer to you, and you'll have to say what type it is. So what are the different types of gastric ulcers, John?
So you have type 1 through 5, and type 1, I usually think of these the low, lesser curvature ulcers that are along the body, and this is due to poor mucosal protection. And then I'm going to group type 4 ulcers in with this as well, but type 4 ulcers are higher on the lesser curve along the cardia, and they're also due to poor mucosal protection. And then I group 2 and 3 together, type 2, where you usually have two ulcers. You have ones in the lesser curve and as well as in duodenum. And this is due to high acid secretion. And then you have your type 3 ulcers, which is usually a pre-pyloric ulcer, and also due to high acid secretion. And then you have your type 5 ulcers using its own island, and that's usually used to NSAID use. And they can occur diffusely throughout the stomach.
So you already mentioned it, but it's a common question. So again, what types are associated with high acid output?
High acid output, you need to think of type 2 and type 3 ulcers.
Exactly, type 2 and type 3. And the way I always remember that is it actually has to do with the behavior of H. pylori and the way it colonizes the stomach, but it's the more distal ulcers. So the ones that are distal in the antrum, the ones that are the duodenum, are associated with high acid secretion. Surgical treatment?
So truncal vagotomy and atrectomy are your mainstay treatment for these patients. And then you also may need to consider a separate ulcer incision if you can't include the ulcer in your atrectomy itself.
And why is that so important for gastric ulcers specifically?
The one reason you do this is that you want to make sure you exclude cancer in these patients. And any patient with an ulcer, you need to make sure they don't have a gastric adenocarcinoma.
Well, any patient in a gastric ulcer, what about duodenal ulcers? How often are those associated with cancer?
Minimally in comparison to
hardly
gastric
ever. Ulcers. Hardly ever. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your reconstruction. So what are your different, let's say you do an atrectomy, what are your different types of reconstruction that you can do?
So the three I think about are we obviously can do your vagotomies with these patients as well. So that's kind of one step before you do any resections. But your Billroth 1, your Billroth 2, and then your Roux-en-Y reconstructions. And your Billroth 1, you're hooking the stomach directly back up to the duodenum, whereas in the Billroth 2, you're hooking it to the jejunum.
Yeah, exactly. So if people out there don't know the difference between a Billroth 1, Billroth 2, and a Roux-en-Y, first off, you got a long way to go. Secondly, just Google it, look at a picture. Let's talk a little bit about if you had your preference in a young, healthy patient, which of those reconstructions are you going to give them?
I would prefer to give them a Roux-en-Y reconstruction versus any of the Billroth procedures.
Right, because what are some of the problems? Billroth 1, you hardly ever see anymore. Billroth 2, what are some problems you can have with the Billroth 2?
Yeah, and this is a question I actually get answered where you have a patient who had a Billroth procedure performed and they're having symptoms such as dumping as well as alkaline reflux. And your Roux-en-Y reconstruction actually is one of those procedures that helps reduce those actual symptoms. So Jason, can you remind me the complications you may get with each of those procedures though?
Yeah, so again, the Billroth 1, you won't see, I've never seen on a test, I've never seen in real life. Billroth 2, Some of the problems you can have, you know, there's name syndromes and name problems with this. Well, one, you can have an obstruction of your afferent loop. So this can present with a patient with, a lot of times they'll give you a patient with nausea and vomiting, PO intolerance, and they'll have a big bout of bilious emesis and their pain will get better. So the pain's improved by having this bilious emesis, and that's due to a transient or intermittent obstruction of their afferent limb. And then there's the afferent loop syndrome, where they have overgrowth of bacteria in their afferent loop, and that can present with megaloblastic anemia from B12 deficiency, and it has to do with an overgrowth of bacteria in that afferent loop. And then there's a bile reflex gastritis. So you have a chronic gastritis from reflux in the bile. And Rowan, what's the treatment for that? You have Billroth 2, you have significant symptoms from bile reflux gastritis. What do you want to do for that patient?
So that's when you convert the patient over to a Roux-en-Y.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I think Roux-en-Y has become the preferred reconstructive technique, especially for young healthy patients that can tolerate the procedure.
And one way I've seen that asked is they'll ask kind of how do you stop this from happening in the first place, and it's just making sure that your limbs between your pancreatic biliary kind of inflow and your stomach are at least 60 centimeters.
Okay, so another very high yield, lots of testable questions is the gastrointestinal stromal tumor, so a GIST. So just some quick hitter high yield. What's the receptor associated with a GIST?
That'd be c-kit. They're all c-kit positive.
And what is a c-kit? What is that?
It's a tyrosine kinase.
Right, so it's a tyrosine kinase receptor. And what's the tyrosine kinase inhibitor that's frequently tested and that can be a treatment for GIST?
It's Gleevec or imatinib. And I think the really interesting thing here that I've seen one question on was that these almost universally become resistant to imatinib after about 3 years, which is why they're not standalone primary treatment. It's not the primary treatment for most of these GISTs. We only use imatinib in certain situations. Can you kind of remind me what exactly those situations are?
So on those, you really want to look at the pathology report. It has to do with the size of the tumor. So, generally, tumors greater than 5 centimeters is kind of the standard answer for patients who get treated with adjuvant therapy with Gleevec, or you look at the number of mitosis per high-powered field, and usually the number is 5 mitosis per high-powered field. So again, greater than 5 centimeters, greater than 5 mitoses is what you want to be looking at there. And what about your resection margins for a GIST?
Generally, negative margins will do, but the book answer is you want a good centimeter.
Right. I think, I'm not sure what's going to be on the abside this time. You essentially want negative margins, but I think if they give you a 1 centimeter, I think that's an adequate margin. What about microscopic margins?
I think you just leave it.
Yeah, you don't need microscopically clear margins with the GIST. So tumors of the stomach. So let's talk a little bit about lymphoma. There's a couple different types. So let's say you have a maltoma. John, what is the what's the going to be the board answer for treatment for a maltoma of the stomach?
So not surgery. Your answer should be triple therapy antibiotics due to the relationship with H. pylori. And also, you can also use radiation therapy, too, if this is not regress in response to the antibiotic therapy.
Right. So the vast majority of maltomas will regress if you treat the underlying cause, which is generally H. pylori. Other lymphomas, interestingly, the stomach is the most likely location for an extranodal lymphoma. I've seen that asked a few times. And what type of, specifically, what type of lymphoma are these lymphomas of the stomach?
So non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, specifically B-cell type, which is also the most common type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right, so a B-cell lymphoma of the stomach. And how do you? What's the treatment for that? You cut them out, or what do you do?
So chemo and radiation is the mainstay option for these patients. There is an exception to this, though, is when a tumor is a stage 1 and confined to the gastric mucosa itself.
So Jason, I remember that a lot of the stuff that I read about the stomach, there's just a bunch of buzzwords that you need to remember. Can we just kind of run through a couple of those real quick?
Sure. Okay. So let's go back and start talking about ulcers again. So Cushing's ulcer, what do you associate that with?
So that's going to be your head injury patient.
Yep. So head trauma followed by gastric ulcer, that's a Cushing's ulcer. And Curling's ulcer?
Just like the curling irons, this is going to be your burn patient.
Yep. So your Curling's ulcer, your curling iron, you burn your hand with the curling iron. So that's a gastric ulcer associated with a burn. And Cameron's ulcer.
And that's generally at the pressure point, kind of on the side of a hiatal hernia.
Okay. So let's say you have gastric cancer metastasis to the ovary. What's the name for that?
That's a Kuchenberg tumor. It's one of my favorite ones.
Okay. And then you have an enlarged supraclavicular node associated with a metastatic GI tumor.
Yeah, that would be a Virchow's node.
And then, Jason, what about the supraumbilical node?
That's your sister Mary Joseph node. Okay, and so last topic for the day is talk about hiatal hernias. So there are four different types of hiatal hernia. John, just walk us through. What are the four types of hiatal hernia?
So there's four types of hiatal hernias. Type one, I think it was your sliding hernia. And then type two is your purely periesophageal hernia, where the part of the stomach slides up and through the hiatus, but the LES remains in a proper position. Type 3 is your combined sliding and periesophageal. And type 4 is where you have the entire stomach into the chest, plus another organ such as the colon, spleen. And you think about it, where type 2, 3, and 4 all need eventual repair. Although in type 2 or in 3, these patients need to be also risk stratified if they have, you know, significant comorbidities. Maybe it's better just to watch these patients. You want to avoid surgery in a frail elderly patient.
And I think the important thing here is that type 4 involves another organ, and that's its major defining point. Because correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think you can have the entire stomach up in a type 3 as long as you don't have another organ up there.
Right.
So as long as we're going for, you know, buzzwords, Rowan, what is Borchardt's triad?
So chest pain after vomiting with fluid in the left chest?
Nope. So you have chest pain, and you have retching without vomiting, and your inability to pass an NG tube. So that's your triad associated with the periesophageal hernia. Makes sense if you think about it. You're going to have chest pain if you have a periesophageal hernia. You're going to be retching. You're not going to be able to vomit because your stomach's going to be herniated, and you're not going to be able to pass an NG tube. So Borchardt's triad. Okay, so John, what's your treatment ultimately going to be for these periesophageal hernias?
The treatment, the final repair would be essentially a Nissen fundoplication, but you know, it's a little more complicated, and rather than perform this procedure simply for GERD, where you actually need to reduce the entire hernia, excise the sac, and then perform the fundoplication. And Jason, remind me what the tenets of a Nissen fundoplication are, please.
So as you said, for periesophageal hernia, you need to reduce the hernia and reduce the hernia sac, excise the hernia sac out of the chest. Then you need to, do an adequate mediastinal mobilization of your esophagus so that you mobilize at least 2 to 3 centimeters of esophagus intra-abdominally. You need to reapproximate your crura. There's multiple different ways of doing that. We won't get into that. Perform your wrap. Over a large, usually like a 50 or 54 French bougie, and kind of a loose floppy wrap, and recreate your natural valve there to prevent reflux. And sometimes you even need to, you know, pexy the stomach into the abdomen in order to maintain that intra-abdominal location. Usually on the ab side, at least, some of the more commonly tested things are complications after a Nissen fundoplication. So, Rowan, what is the most common thing you're going to hear? You have a patient that you just performed a fundoplication on. What's the complaint going to be? What's the most common complication overall?
So the most common complaint is dysphagia.
Yep. So dysphagia. So how do you sort that out? Let's say it's early post-op. It's you know, your post-op day two, post-op day three, the patient's complaining of dysphagia.
Yeah. So a lot of that is expected, and it's one of the reasons why we put these patients on liquid diets afterwards. But if you're concerned about it, you can get a barium swallow and actually take a look at the lumen itself.
So I think a key distinction there is going to be, is the patient tolerating their own secretions? If the patient's not even tolerating their own secretions, that's a patient that you need to think about taking back to the operating room, because what's the most common cause of dysphagia postoperatively?
It would just be swelling of that wrap.
Or the wrap's too tight. The wrap's too tight is generally the most, you know, the most common problem for dysphagia. Now, I, as you say, the edema from the surgery itself can contribute to that, and most of these patients will respond to conservative therapy as the edema goes down. The dysphagia improves, but I have seen questions where they'll give you a patient who's, you know, has foamy saliva and they can't even tolerate their own secretions. And the answer in that instance is going to be go back to the operating room and take down your wrap. If they're just having a little bit of dysphagia, you treat them conservatively, wait for the edema to go down.
So Jason, what if I can't actually get the esophageal dissection that you were talking about, and I actually can't get the esophagus down into the stomach?
Yeah, so this is the often tested, hardly ever seen Colley's gastroplasty, where you actually elongate the esophagus by coming down onto your separating or tuberalizing your stomach a little bit further by dividing along your greater curvature. I haven't yet even talked to anybody that's actually done that. Usually you can get enough mobilization of the esophagus. If you can't get enough esophagus, the answer is generally you need to dissect higher into the mediastinum. But that will show up on tests. That will certainly show up on tests and potentially even the abscite. Okay, well, I think that covers it. That was a quick and dirty review of the stomach for the abscite. Certainly not comprehensive. I think mostly right. Thanks, John, of course, and to our special guest, Dr. Sheldon.
And Jason, thanks for giving me the day off tomorrow for doing this. I appreciate it.
Over my dead body.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.